Turning our attention to home renovation and repair issues, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Questions for our guests, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. John, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Yeah, thanks, Larry. Always fun.
And Chad, great to have you with us, too.
Thank you, Larry. It's great to be here.
Somebody posted, Mary Beth posted on my Facebook page a question for you guys. And it this is for South Central Pennsylvania, not Northern Wisconsin. But how, she wonders, how thick and deep does my concrete pad have to be for a brick grill or fireplace? I think I can just use a floating slab, but what prep work should I do before pouring it? Would you needle?
Well, for a typical slab out in the yard, a typical procedure would be to have 4 to 6 inches of crushed stone as a base with some sand in it, and then the slab itself should probably be about 4 inches thick.
Okay.
That's fairly typical for a patio or for a slab like that.
Okay. All right. So 4 inches of stone and sand and then another 4 inches of concrete, and there you go.
That would be pretty typical. Yep.
Beverly in Delavan has a question for you guys. Let's go there. Hi, Bev.
Good morning.
Morning.
My question is, we are redoing our parlor, and our house was built in 1852, and it has crown molding, but the crown molding is plaster, and it has several layers of paint on it, and a lot of it has chipped, and it was painted over. Is there any way or any type of a machine or tool that we can use to kind of smooth that out a little bit?
So you're not taking it off.
You mean taking the crown molding off?
You're not removing it.
No. We just want to be able to paint.
Yeah, I can envision how one might make some sort of a template to use to kind of pull across that profile with some thin-set plaster or drywall material to kind of fill it in and smooth it out. But that's a very unique situation. Of course, having plaster trim in an old home is not uncommon. But that would require a skilled plasterer to restore. But what I'm envisioning is that you would end up having some sort of a profile. It wouldn't be a blade. You'd probably end up crafting it out of some material that could be easily cut. And you'd pull that across the crown to fill out the divots in it. So
that's interesting. Okay, we'll give it a try.
All right, thank you.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck. Thanks for calling. Dan in Montfort, let's go to you now. Hi, Dan.
Yes, I have a question about water damming and what causes it. I think I know and what to do about that.
So water damming, ice damming up on the eaves?
Yes, ice damming, that's what I mean.
Yeah, so the once we get a fair bit of snow up on that roof and it starts to melt. It can start melting for a couple of reasons. It can start melting, obviously, just naturally by outdoor environment and temperature and sunshine. But if we're starting to get really thick ice built up at the eaves, often it's coming back to the inefficiency of the home where we have heat from inside the house finding its way into that attic. And I'm going to assume that you have a vented attic space. And once that heat from the house gets into the attic, and oftentimes it may or may not be flushed out of the attic adequately, so the temperature in the attic warms up, the temperature of the underside of the roof sheathing warms up, melts that snow, and the water runs down to the eaves and then refreezes because it's at the overhang. There's no more heat there. It's at outdoor temperature. So the that water that's running down the roof slowly accumulates. The ice thickens. We've got to stop that heat loss first, ideally from an air leakage standpoint into that attic. So we need that assessment to know whether how leaky the house is to the attic. And then we insulate the attic adequately to maybe an at least an R50 is pretty standard these days of an insulating value. And then the last step is attic ventilation to make sure that that's adequate. So first is air tightness, insulating, and then we might turn our attention to attic ventilation.
So it's not necessarily coming behind the drywall, if the drywall didn't have enough insulation or there's cracks behind the walls or even the ceiling, it's not necessarily that. It's more coming from inside the attic, attic warming up.
That's more typical. So there may be some contribution of those exterior walls being uninsulated or underinsulated and some heat rising up to that top plate and contributing. But if generally we're not getting the water accumulation to where there's a large concern of ice and maybe that weight pulling on the gutters, et cetera, there's usually going to be more snow melt from higher up on that roof that's going to cause that ice dam.
So my last question, if the spray foam, if I was to have someone come in with spray foam and spray foam, say the ceiling in the attic, it'd be the bottom of the roof, something like that, would that help? Or just throw an extra, going up in the attic and throwing an extra 3-4 insulation that's already existing?
Mm-hmm.
That's not probably a for sure fix, or would that pretty much kind of fix it?
Well, we need to do some performance testing. We need to really identify where those leaks are and how big they are and where they're located. And that often requires a blower door test, which is a large fan set in the doorway of the home to depressurize the building so we can clearly identify the extent of the air leakage, because that's going to, before we would insulate, we need to know the extent of the air leakage within that structure, from the house to the attic. And the best way is a blower door. Next, obviously, it's moving insulation around, finding the plumbing walls, lighting, just our typical penetrations that go through our ceiling. And we need to air seal those effectively before we would insulate. We wouldn't rush to spray foam the underside of our roof deck. That's we maybe have alternatives that are going to be less expensive to spray foam.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I was to call Energy Star and they would come out and do their Energy Star, do their work that they do, they can give you a pretty accurate diagnosis as to where the problem is and how to fix it.
Absolutely. That's your best first step.
It's amazing. I tell you, we had it done on both the house we're living in now and the one that we're going to be living in, and it's really really amazing what they can show.
Yeah, the thermal imaging camera along with the blower door is,
that's quite a revelation. Watch that.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling, Dan. Good luck to you. Appreciate it very much. And Jeff in Suamico, we turn to you next. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Larry. I have a question. I'm wondering about the feasibility of using my water heater as a heat source to heat one room of the home with in-floor or under-floor radiant heating. We've got an older ranch home, stick-built, and we've got one room that my wife uses as an office that's just not warm enough for her, and I don't want to heat the whole house. And I'm wondering if that's a possibility. I've looked online, haven't found a whole lot of information. I used to install solar heating systems, so I think I could figure out the controls and the pumps and that, but I'm just wondering if that's something that I could possibly do, and would it work?
Yes, well, it is possible. We have done it on a couple of projects, and some of the critical variables that you're going to have to keep in mind is that floor needs to be well insulated underneath the piping that you put in, or at least if it's a well-sealed and insulated crawl space or basement that's part of the envelope, that's fine. But you don't want to be putting down these pipes on an uninsulated slab on grade, for example. And it really depends on the square footage of the space and of the area that's being heated. But the projects where we have done something similar to this have been less than 400 square feet. And I think that I'm not sure what the threshold is. I mean, it's something that we worked out with our heating contractor, but that it was definitely the more cost-effective way to not put in an expensive boiler system in a house that otherwise has forced air heat and cooling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One addition is the efficiency of that water heater. I assume you're moving with natural gas, a water heater. But code does, I believe, require 78% efficiency, AFUE efficiency, or better. So often most standard water heaters are going to be much lower efficiency than that unless you go out of your way to identify one with the correct efficiency rating. So it's not necessarily, if we're using a standard water heater, the most efficient way to go, but I understand some of the options that you're considering.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thanks very much.
We will turn to Sherry in Appleton next. Hi, Sherry.
Hello. I just have a comment about the woman that called in about the plaster crown molding.
Yes.
And there's a great product on the market called SpackFast. It's a real lightweight spackling, and it fills in any surface that's uneven. You can use it. You can just apply it and then let it dry. It dries in about maybe, you know, if it's really thin, even less than 30 minutes, and you can sand it down slightly with a really fine-grade sandpaper. So anywhere you have, like, paint chips, or you just when you want to repaint it and you want it to look nice and smooth and not notice that chippy area, you can fill it in with that. And I've even used it outdoors. I live in an old house built in the 1800s, and it had, like, the wood trim around the windows, and there'd be some dry rot, and I'd clean it out a little bit, and I'd fill the cracks with that, and I've had it on my windows for, you know, 15 years, and it holds up really, really well. It's just called SpackFast.
SpackFast.
And it's very easy to sand, easy to work with, easy to clean up. It's a nice product.
All right. Thank you very much. You guys work with it at all ever?
We're typically, and we're using a similar, more common product, which is just a drywall compound for mm-hmm. some of these sorts of applications. Mm-hmm. And it's a fast drying compound as well that sands nicely. It can also be wet sanded, which is essentially taking a damp sponge. So it's very versatile.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sherry, for calling. Appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. And let's turn to Sophie in Waukesha next. Hi, Sophie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask about cleaning the vents of the house or the ducts.
Ductwork cleaning, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what's your recommendation? And do they really clean all the residual? Because the house was built in 75, and I smell some dust coming through the vents. And what's the average cost, and what should I look for the company to call, or what's your advice, please?
Okay.
So cleaning the air ducts really have been a recommendation. I've recommended that really if there's health concerns in the house, or if you have odors or things like that that you just can't get rid of, then that might be an option for you. Cleaning the ducts just as a matter of course on an annual or every several years, I haven't really felt too strongly that there has been a need to clean the ductwork. Though, if, as I said, there's problems in the house, then we might want to include that in one of the options to remediate smelly odors or health concerns that you may have.
Yeah, another thing that I would just add to be thinking about is that sometimes we find in homes that were built in the 70s or more recently, they're quite a bit tighter than older construction. And so one of the contributing factors to odors lingering is the absence of a good fresh air intake in the home. Old homes get fresh air just by accident all the time, around every little nook and cranny. You know, windows, doors, the walls themselves aren't very well sealed without some considerable renovation efforts. But a newer home can be incredibly tight. And back when builders didn't fully understand all of these issues, you know, that can be a significant improvement, just bringing in controlled fresh air into the home. And then your ventilation fans will work better because there will be that makeup air, that fresh air coming in to allow the stale or musty or just odorous air to leave. So
a heat recovery system you're talking about.
Yeah, it's a ranch house, so it will be easy job, I think. And what how much are we talking about for cleaning, about average?
Oh, to clean your ductwork?
Yeah, it depends on, obviously, the size of the house and the number of registers. But I'm going to give a broad range here because I'm not 100% sure. But maybe it's in the $500-$600 to $1,200 range.
And putting in a fresh air intake, if that's something that would be considered, if the duct cleaning doesn't work, that's going to cost probably $500 to $700 for a fresh air intake, which is less, less extensive than putting in an actual air exchange system.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. An air exchange system is a few thousand dollars.
Correct.
Yeah. There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Sophie. Appreciate it. Our guest today, Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. You can go to his website at chadscarpentry.com. John Viner, who's project manager, in fact, senior project manager for educational programs at the Energy Center of Wisconsin. You can go to ecw.org for his website. I'm Larry Mueller. Rachel Owens, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here as we talk home renovation and repair with Chad Spade and John Viner. Join in with your questions. Actually, have an open line. Finally, you can get on at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Mary in Wisconsin Rapids, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Mary. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, okay, what I'm calling about is my husband and I went to a presentation this week regarding a company called APS, and they're selling a product called Energy Shield. And what it is, it's a lightweight foil consisting of four layers, and it's bonded together. And what you do is you put it over, you lay it over, it's in sheets, in a roll, and you lay it over your existing insulation in your attic. And they're claiming that, and what it does is it radiates the heat back into the house for the winter, and then it radiates the sun when it comes down into your house in the summer back out so that your house stays cooler and then your house stays warmer in the winter. So I guess my question is, do you have any knowledge on this? Have you ever heard of this product or company, and what are your thoughts on it?
Well, I haven't heard of this particular company, but there's certainly been a number of foil-faced insulation products being proposed within the industry. We find them to be a little bit more available and utilized in hot climates, so down south, they may use that a little bit more effectively for cooling applications. Here in Wisconsin, in a cold climate, it hasn't been really proven that this adds, not necessarily our value, because that's not what they're after. The product that's foil-faced, it's very reflective. It's trying to reduce the amount of radiant heat that's lost from the house, so we lose heat through air leakage. This radiant barrier will not stop that. So the air leakage rate of heat loss in our house will not be lowered. The rate of conduction, another way that heat is lost in our house, will not be lowered because of the product. Or maybe that'll be arguable, depending on how much insulating value we add. But primarily it's after radiant heat, just heat of a warm object emitting to a colder object. And that foil is going to reflect that radiant heat, which becomes, is a portion of the total heat loss in the house. But I'm not an advocate that we're going to see significant energy savings from that. Some statistics that I've read and seen haven't really proven it in a very strong fashion that it's going to make and reduce our utility bills significantly. There may be some benefits in cooling. I wouldn't argue that. So if you are a heavy user of air conditioning, that may be another benefit to you. But in the heating mode, in Wisconsin, in a very cold climate, I think we're going to be negligible in the amount of benefit that we have.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling.
And the only thing I would add to that, and this is something that any installer or manufacturer would have to answer to their product, but the thing I am concerned about is introducing another potential vapor barrier into the assembly. And if you were laying, say, a piece of plastic across an attic on top of the insulation, that would be a dangerous situation because you'd likely get condensation on the underside of that plastic in the wintertime, and then that would, if there was enough of it, it would drip back down into the insulation and the structure. So we always have to be concerned about the unintended consequences of materials like this.
Thanks again for calling, Mary. Bonnie in Mount Horeb wonders, what's the best flooring to put down in a kid's bedroom in order to get the value back out of your home when you go to sell it? The room is small, I think 8x9. I'm looking into a wood laminate for it.
Well, that might be a perfectly good way to go. It's certainly easy to clean. I am not a big advocate for the laminate products generally. I prefer wood or tile, things which are more natural materials, and the laminates often have a lot of formaldehyde in them and things like that, but they're very easy to clean, and there are some healthier versions of these products. If you're purely looking at cleaning and wearability, and my first thought for a kid's room is to put a drain in the middle. Okay, well, I'm just...
Oh, man. Well, we have another email from Tom in Wanakee who'd like you guys' opinion on cabinet refacing versus cabinet replacement. What do you think? That's probably situational.
Yeah, a lot depends on the quality of or the condition of the actual current cabinet boxes. And then the big variable is whether or not the layout of the room, often a kitchen, but it could be an entertainment center or storage in a living room or something, is the design of the current layout of, maximizing your use of the space. Or if you're looking to alter the layout significantly, then oftentimes it doesn't make sense to do a resurfacing. But if you're going to keep the same layout and you just want a new look, it's a great way to go. Yeah. You're going to save a lot of money and material and labor. You're going to reuse that box. You can upgrade the hardware and upgrade the doors and the facing. Sometimes we will paint the cabinet boxes to give a fresh new finish to the box and then put a door, whether it be painted or stained. I mean, it can be a nice nice feature. So.
And a lot cheaper.
Yes.
A lot cheaper. Steve in Park Ridge, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a 100-year-old house, and I understand there are new rules for lead abatement for remodeling painting. Could you speak to those?
Sure. About 10 years ago, there was legislation passed that's taken a while to work its way through the bureaucracy, but there are new rules that went into effect kind of informally on Earth Day 2010. Enforcement of those rules was delayed until the first of the year on January 1st of 2011. And so now technically the EPA and essentially the various health departments of the 50 states are now enforcing this new rule, which essentially forces remodeling contractors or anyone that disturbs older buildings that were built prior to 1978, which are likely to have lead contamination in them, in the paints and other finishes. It forces us to take precautions to make sure that we're not unnecessarily harming our workers or our clients and occupants of the building. So the details of the rules can be found online. And in Illinois, I'm not sure if the Health and Human Services Department of Illinois has been authorized, or if the EPA is over the federal EPA is overseeing it. Wisconsin is one of a handful of states that has gained authority to create its own rules and to enforce those rules. So, you know, the details in Illinois you'll have to look into, but essentially it has to do with containing dust and protecting the health of the occupants while you're remodeling.
Okay, there you go. Thank you, Steve. Jennifer in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Jen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about radon. I forget the word you use when you put in a system to try and get rid of the radon. We have a tri-level, and the lowest level is where our family room is, and the ratings that we've gotten are just at the cusp of what the EPA lists as acceptable levels of radon. And when I have people come in to sort of pitch a system to me, they're saying they have to go through my foundation and, you know, vent a fan and all this sort of stuff, and they're not guaranteeing me that they would get it below the level of 4, which I guess is kind of the cutoff. And yet I have small children, and I'm a bit neurotic about sort of, you know, not wanting them exposed. So I was wondering if you guys have any thoughts about radon systems, you know, testing for it, what's the best system to have, the usefulness of them, anything you could sort of speak to would be helpful.
Sure. There's two types of tests. Usually they classify them as a short-term test and a long-term test. And initially I'm thinking you maybe just had a short-term test, because I think that's the 4 threshold that we're speaking to.
We had a test that was like a 4-day long test.
Mm-hmm.
And it had varying levels during that 4-day, but they, you know, sort of average it out. And I did have a couple then contractors to come out based on that. And we had another test that kind of read at the same level. And the one guy said, well, you can do like a 6-month test, mm-hmm. you know, and get sort of what you're looking at, you know, winter, summer, you know, that kind of thing. And we haven't done that yet. And I guess, you know, and then some people are telling me the EPA level is sort of, they're looking at it and thinking it's too low, and that really it isn't, you know, a huge health risk factor. And I'm trying to educate myself, but there's a lot of conflicting information. So the short answer to your question is that we had the 4-day test. We have not had a 6-month test.
I would like to recommend that you purchase a plug-in detector, which is something that we provide to all of our clients when we remodel a basement. There is a company that sells these online. They cost about $130.
Okay.
I don't have that website here, but if you give us contact information to the producer, then I'm sure I'll be able to get that to you off air. But basically, we give these plug-in detectors to people, and you'll see a digital readout. It's similar to a carbon monoxide detector that will show you if carbon monoxide rates spike, and it will start to beep if you get over that 4 parts per
whatever. Yeah.
Right. And it is true that radon remediation can be tricky, because it is important to essentially create negative pressure under the foundation of the house so that the radon goes out through your fan and doesn't come into the home.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, if there's a drain tile that goes all the way around the foundation and they can tap into that system, that's the best, most effective way to get connection to a lot of the soil. As far as whether or not the 4 parts per milliliter reading is high or low, I mean, I will say that the second leading cause of lung cancer in the United States is exposure to radon.
Right.
It's second only to smoke, you know, from cigarettes. So radon is a real threat, and it is something that we don't know is there unless we test for it. So many of us are exposed to radon potentially all the time or through our childhoods, and we didn't know about it because it just we weren't looking for it.
So let me just make sure that I'm clear. So I would get this detector. That would kind of give me a good indication on the particular area I'm concerned with, how over this 4 points for whatever limit, and that would probably give me a good indication of really if I should look into spending on a system. And then you're saying that I want to be able to tap into some type of drainage around the outside, the full outside of the house, and look for a system that use that to help get rid of the radon.
We often put in a drain tile and sump system in conjunction with the radon remediation system, so that we're essentially doing a variety of things for the homeowner at one time. You were dealing with the radon most effectively. We are putting in a system that will help prevent flooding in the basement. And then by having that detector, you can put it in the places where you live. If you find that radon isn't a problem up on the living level and the basement really isn't a place where the kids hang out, I mean, you can test for that, and you can decide whether or not it's something you want to invest in remediating.
Okay. Thank you very much. And so if I stay on the line, can get my info?
Yeah, we'll put you on hold. And Dave Potratz, by the way, is our on-air producer right now. And Dave will take your information, and then Chad can get back to you. So
okay.
I'm going to put you on hold here. I think I've got you on hold. And now Dave will get that information from you. Terry in Glenwood City will turn to you next. Hi, Terry. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, we'd like to put in a wood cook stove. Actually, we have a pot. And we're working with a small kitchen, very small. It's about 11 by 11. And we know we have to have a air barrier between the wall that we're going to put it on and the cook stove. We thought about rock, but we figured that's going to take up way too much room off this wall and floor space. So we thought maybe about some of the old pressed tin ceilings, something in that effect. And we don't have we don't know where to start to even look for something like that.
Mm-hmm. So you were looking for a fire barrier behind that wood stove, up against your, say, plastered wall.
Yes, it'd be an inside wall, and we know we have to have a barrier, but we, on top of this, we'd like to have a little texture in the background.
Yeah, is it a new wood cook stove?
It's not brand new. No,
it's not brand new. So the first is looking to see what that manufacturer says as far as thickness of metal or types of metal. If we go that route, would be. Important. The tin, the old tin ceilings, that to me that seems pretty thin. And we're going to need something a little bit more there against on the back side. But look at the clearances for that wood stove. And maybe they'll allow you 6 inches up to a combustible material. So that's key to finding out first and maybe doing a little digging online to find that. Chad, do you have?
Well, there are a variety of thin veneer products that can be used that are safe to have behind a lot of wood-burning stoves. But again, John's right. You'll want to look at what the specs are on the product, and then you might consider some of those thinner veneered products.
Sure.
Whereabouts do we go looking for something like that?
You get the name of the stove, and then I would just go online to the manufacturer, right?
I would think so.
Yeah. Yep.
Or a local stove dealer might be able to lend you a hand
sure.
and point you in.
Right.
Sure. That's another good idea.
Right.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Terry. Appreciate your call. And we have an email from Bill in Menominee wondering if he says, I'm wondering if I'll have spalling or other problems of the Dunn County sandstone walls of a basement if I isolate them outside a foam insulation envelope with airspace in between. They would then freeze solid where there isn't much freezing now. Any thoughts?
So foam to the interior, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And then an airspace behind there.
Yep.
The key is keeping the moisture off there from the inside. So that foam insulation, if it's up against a frame, if we're going to frame the inside and then put foam board, because we have this you know, uneven surface that we're not going to just be able to put it. So we hold it off, keep that inch space, and really create a nice airtight seal. And we need to know that that's 100% airtight, not 90% airtight. So it really is going to take some fine detail there to know that the top, the bottom, the sides, all edges are going to be truly airtight and be long-term airtight. So then I think that's going to be the biggest key besides the outside drainage that we obviously need to take care of for rainwater.
Yeah, I would agree. I'm not sure, you know, every home can offer some unique challenges sometimes because mm-hmm. we don't know exactly how things were done originally, but that foundation I think would do just fine if, you know, if the building were just an outbuilding. So, and that's not necessarily a heated building. So, you know, that I think John's right.
Okay. On to Shirley in Johnson Creek. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some walls in my house that looks like somebody painted over wallpaper paste.
No.
And it is showing through, and I want to repaint. Is there some way I can remove that wallpaper paste, or is there something I can paint over the top that it won't come through?
Well, this is always a tricky problem. You can clean the walls, and there are different products that can be used, though I don't want to claim to be an expert on that, and I'm hesitant to give advice on that particular issue. It's a little bit of hit and miss, but sometimes like a TSP cleaning product can be used to clean those walls. Sometimes you just have to go back to, you know, you either tear it off or you skim coat it to get a new surface that can be reliably painted. You know, or put up a quarter inch of a new drywall sometimes. It really depends on whether you're having any success in cleaning off the glue that was there. And if it's been painted over, it's very hard to do that, to remove it.
It is.
Yeah. There you go. Not the greatest news in the world, but there you have it, Shirley. Thank you very much for calling. Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison, John Viner, Senior Project Manager at the Energy Center of Wisconsin, our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Home renovation and repair on our minds today with Chad Spade and John Viner. And a couple of events coming up. Chad, there's the NARI Remodeling Expo is coming February 4th through the 6th. In Madison.
Yes, that's correct, Larry. That's an annual event here in Madison. We like to think that the NARI Expo is the expo for remodeling contractors. It is our local professional association event where our members and affiliates are able to promote their services and expertise. It's a great opportunity to meet a lot of experts and professionals and learn about proper techniques and new products and how to solve problems and improve your home. There are also a wide range of seminars that are provided. The seminars are, in fact, free. There is admission to go into the expo hall, but you can attend the seminars for free if you don't want to go into the expo hall. So I just point that out. And you can go online to get more details about all the exhibitors and the seminars and the hours. It is the first weekend, as you say, of February, Friday through Sunday. And if you go to narimadison.org, that's narimadison.org, you can get more information.
Excellent. And then, John, you have a Better Buildings, Better Business conference coming up.
Yeah, this is our ninth annual conference. It's our premier Wisconsin homegrown for builders, remodelers, all the trades related to residential construction. So this conference is for the residential trade contractors primarily, not that homeowners couldn't attend. We have, it's 2 days, March third and fourth, and we have a pre-conference, couple sessions on the second related to efficient use of plumbing and water, efficient plumbing activities, plumbing strategies, I should say, and ways to conserve water, and also the pre-conference on mechanical ventilation systems. There's tracks from renewable energy to how to grow your business as a contractor, getting mm-hmm. involved in the home performance industry. So this is where people come and unite and be a part.
And where and how do we find more information on that? It's ecw.org/betterbuildings.
Better buildings. So ecw.org/betterbuildings. And you'll find out the conference highlights there as well.
All right, great. Let's go to Don in Green Bay next. Don, hello to you.
Hi. I have a question. We have an old farmhouse that's about 100 years old, and we recently had the attic insulation redone with blown cellulose. And before we did that, we had it air sealed with a foam product. And today I noticed that all the attic windows are frosted over, and I was wondering about that.
So the attic windows, this is a living space up in the attic, or?
No, it's not. There's just a couple of small circular windows, kind of decorative windows in the attic that mm-hmm. you can see from the outside of the building, and I've noticed they were frosted over.
Okay, and so we put the insulation on the floor then within that attic, just to be clear.
Yes,
yep.
That's right, yep. And we had the blower door test done before we did this mm-hmm. this project. So and so we air sealed it, and that's why I'm kind of wondering how the condensation is getting up there.
And that condensation's on the inside of those windows.
It appears appears so.
And a little bit of moisture is going to travel into that attic, even if we have that lid of the house, the ceiling, 100% airtight. Just we get moisture travel through air leakage that we hope we address through the air tightness. We get it through diffusion, which is simply water molecules moving through the plaster or the sheetrock and into the attic. We're just not going to be able to stop that entirely. And it doesn't mean there's necessarily a problem up there or a large concern. Maybe a little more attic ventilation might be just simply the trick here is to allow an easier path for that moisture that does get into that attic space from the house to escape.
I see. Okay. We have good attic ventilation, but the one thing we don't have is we don't have ventilation on the eaves. And it's because some of our roof lines go, or some of the interior walls kind of creep up into the roof line a little bit in some areas of our house. And so I'm not sure how to get an eave vent in there to actually create a better venting situation.
And I guess I would, if this happens a handful of times a year when it's 0 degrees outside, when it's very cold at night, then as long as we're not damaging the windows, or if they are in good condition, usually they're just an older window up there that we're not terribly concerned about. But so a handful of times, condensation up there isn't going to be a problem, but we want to keep an eye on it so we don't get any type of moisture standing on some wood members or frost within that attic. If we started seeing some white frost when we went up there or poked our head up there from the attic hatch or stairway, then we're going to be a little more concerned. And of course, if it just happens with a regular basis, but if it's intermittent in the very coldest part of the years, I probably wouldn't be too concerned.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Darwin in DeSoto, on to you now. Hi, Darwin.
Good morning. How you be today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
I have an excellent fix for this man with his ice coming in his house upstairs.
Okay.
All right. What's going on is his furnace in the basement, whatever type it is, it doesn't matter, you know, year-round, whatever. But this furnace has an intake before it gets heated up by the natural gas or LP or whatever he's using. By the filter, most of them things do have a filter, you know, for the clean air to go through the house. somewhere from the outside, run a 4-inch pipe. I prefer galvanized. That's what I have here for me. And run that pipe and then use an elbow, whatever configuration you must, but get that 4-inch pipe so it's right in front of that filter so the furnace is sucking the air from the pipe. And once this is installed, you will find you can put your hand in front of the pipe and the air is coming out roughly 45 to 50 miles an hour. It'll freeze your fingers in about 30 seconds. That's how fast that furnace is sucking up the air. And all of a sudden, you're going to find out this entire house is going to warm up. There is no intake nowhere else for anything to come sneaking in and putting frost in your windows on any story, anywhere. Your basement windows will melt the snow around the steel protectors going around it. It's amazing what it will do. And no one seems to have forbearance to put in an intake system on their heaters.
Yeah, that intake is certainly one way to ventilate the house, to dry the house out. So that's a strategy to lower the humidity, and we can reduce some condensation for that. But there are some concerns about putting that intake too close to the furnace fan. That really cold air hitting that heat exchanger of that forced air furnace isn't always the best idea. And we do have to be careful about over dehumidification. A lot of people cannot handle low relative humidities or low moisture levels in the house, so we need some control there. But if we're speaking to window condensation, dehumidification certainly is one strategy.
All right, there you go. What's the normal, considered to be the normal humidity level for a house in wintertime, or what's kind of most comfortable for most people?
So a lot of people in the wintertime really don't like it below 30%, and they'd love to have it around 40-50%. But you really have to have a well-designed house in Wisconsin to have 40-50% relative humidity in the wintertime in your house and not have a lick of condensation on the windows or some other moisture concerns. Not that it isn't done, and homes can be designed well to achieve that. But most of us are going to try to, when the temperature outdoors get below 20 and get in the teens and single digits, that relative humidity has to lower within the house, or we are going to have a more chance of condensation. So it all depends on outdoor temperature. As it gets really cold, we might get 25-30% relative humidity to try to keep it our moisture levels under control, and we don't have to put a rag on the windowsills.
Yeah, and a really interesting thing to contemplate is that for years, heating contractors have sold us humidifiers to put on our furnaces because those old homes were very leaky and they would get very dry.
Yeah.
And now in a really tight high performance home, we're having to install dehumidification systems to deal with excessive humidity sometimes just driving through the foundation. So there are, humidity is something that our strategies to deal with it depend on the conditions in the particular home.
Okay.
And how the people live in it.
Yep. There you go. Thanks, Darwin, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Barry a chance from Muskego to join us. Barry, hello.
Hello. Yeah, I have a question about radon levels in a home.
Yes.
Okay, I ran short and long-term tests in my house. And the values that I got out were like 4.1 and 4.2. But all the literature and everything I hear always uses the 4 point, or just plain 4 value. So my question is there a tolerance on that 4, or is that a definite action point where I need to take to do something about it?
Well, I try to put this into perspective. I mean, when you've got something that can cause harm, for example, there are chemicals in our drinking water that we have to decide how much is acceptable and when does that level start to pose an unreasonable risk. And so the 4 parts per milliliter or you know, that number is a number that has been determined by the EPA to be an action level, but that doesn't mean that, I mean, that increases your risk if you're at that level or higher. That doesn't mean that you can't suffer ill effects from radon if you live in a home that has less than four. It's still a threat. But you may live in a home that is higher than 20 and never contract lung cancer. I mean, you know, it's an odds game. It's a risk assessment. So there's no, you know, it's just like getting skin cancer or something. I mean, it's a risk. And so, you know, how much exposure to the sun is acceptable. And so if you're right at four, you've got kind of a difficult decision to make when you're thinking about the health and safety of your family. But, you know, radon levels will fluctuate throughout the year often. And in fact, they tend to spike in the wintertime because the ground is frozen around us, but the foundation is not frozen.
Mm. There you go. Thank you for calling. Chad Spade and John Viner, our guests. They'll be with us right up until 12:30 here on the Ideas Network. Talking home renovation and repair today with Chad Spade of Chad's Carpentry in Madison and John Viner of the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Lots of callers online. I think we'll just go right to the phones. And Steve in Madison, it is your turn. Thanks for waiting.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking the call. I've got a basement with in-floor heating, and I'm looking for some direction on possible coverings, natural. I realize carpet, vinyl, tile are real common for coverings on you know, concrete, but I'm actually looking for some direction on it. Is there applications and how to go about it for wood, cork, other products?
Well, when you have in-floor heating, the thing you want to be thinking about is whether or not the material will radiate that heat effectively. So one of the reasons that tile and some laminate products are often good to use is there's very little thermal resistance, and they're going to, you know, transmit that heat. If you put a carpet over it with a carpet pad, you know, you're going to be buffering that heat a little bit. But carpet is, you know, just without the heat is typically a little warmer. So it's a trade-off. We do want to make sure, and this is, of course, I mean, the house already has it, but if, you know, if the slab is not insulated underneath, that can be an expensive system to run or operate. And so that's always a concern. But, you know, we don't want to insulate over top of that radiant floor system. So,
are there laminate products out there that have a good thermal transfer?
Now, I would recommend talking directly to a floor supplier about those issues, because they're going to be able to give you information about the various products and you know, what they would recommend.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. And Tim in Fort Collins, Colorado, on to you. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I was hoping you guys might be able to give me some information on thermal non-contact thermal infrared energy detectors for inside a house. They're little gadgets, and you just point they're kind of pistol-looking things, and you just point them, and they have a little laser that goes and hits like an area along the wall or around your window, and you can tell if there's an energy leak there or a... Is that clear enough what I'm saying?
Sure.
Sure, the non-contact thermometers. And what are you looking? You're looking just to have that available to find maybe some cold spots in your house to...
Exactly.
Maybe identify insulation levels or where you may be able to stop air leakage?
Yeah, especially my house is an old double brick house, and it's been, you know, kind of cobbled together, and, you know, there's all sorts of, I'm sure, little spots in the corners that are leaking.
Yeah, so it's going to give you a little piece of the puzzle, right? It's not going to really I think, allow you to develop a work scope and a plan to how to address the house as a whole. I think it may pinpoint some options for you, or pinpoint some cold air, cold spots. But ultimately, you're going to have to come back down to get a home performance assessment with a blower door and a thermal imaging camera to develop really truly a strong work scope where you're going to be able to save energy and become more comfortable. You're not going to be able to really identify what needs to be done simply with that non-contact thermometer.
Oh, so a thermal imaging camera would be done through your energy center or where I live also, we have such options, is you would say far superior?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The far superior option is the thermal imager, where you're going to get that thermal image, hot and cold spots, and they can put that into pictures, into a report, and then doing that in conjunction with an air leakage test with the blower door. Boy, it doesn't get any better than that, and it's a few $100s, but if you've got home improvement projects planned, it's well worth the money just to go that route and put that $130 for a non-contact thermometer or so for a good one, or $99 sometimes we'll see for a decent one, and put that towards a really strong energy audit with a blower door and thermal image.
Yep.
Oh, great. Well, I appreciate that information. I will change my mind.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Tim. Appreciate your call. All the way from Fort Collins, Colorado. Let's go to Rob in Phillips, Wisconsin. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
What can we do for you?
Yes, I have a walkout basement, true story, and it's got an open staircase going upstairs.
Okay.
And I've got gas forced air heating. And I have two bedrooms downstairs that are always about 15 or 20 degrees colder than the upstairs. And if I turn the heat up to warm up the bedrooms downstairs, it gets unbearably hot upstairs. I was wondering if those infrared space heater things that you hear everybody talking about, if they're worth investing in, or are they just a waste of money?
Well, it all comes back to how much it's going to cost to make that comfortable in that walkout basement. That certainly can be a challenge. How old is the house?
It was built in 1990.
Really, we want to know how well that slab, the edge of the slab is insulated in the foundation wall. If we're going to try to fight against an uninsulated slab edge at that walkout and the rest of the below-grade walls, gets pretty tough to keep that walkout, that lower level, comfortable. Not that we couldn't try. There may be some other options, whether we are able to increase the heated flow to the basement. So I assume you have one thermostat?
Yes, we have one thermostat upstairs. It's just above the stairwell where it pulls up between the basement.
Right. So we're a common option is trying to increase that heat flow and into the lower level and decrease it in the upstairs, and trying to strike a balance without creating discomfort in a bathroom or a bedroom in the upper level. So that may be an option. If an electric heater, and we're going to use electric heat, which is going to be more expensive, but where it may apply is if you have a bedroom that's infrequently used and you have a house guest and you want to keep it warmer, go for the electric heater to really supplement that. I think that's an okay way to go. If we're going to try to heat this full time through the winter and we want to operate that electric heater, then we're going to investigate a little better options, try to keep that lower level warm with that higher efficient, less expensive forced air furnace, which is going to take a professional heating contractor to see if we can bring more airflow to that lower level.
Okay, yeah, it's very full-time used by my two boys, so probably just contact a local heating contractor and have them come in and take a look.
Yeah, that's a good way to go. The energy audit may identify some options, but if the slab edge and the slab itself is not insulated, it's a pretty expensive proposition to change that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think the slab's heated, but the walls are insulated.
No.
Right, so that foundation that's losing the heat and all that concrete, trying to blow more air around into that basement. It never, I'll be honest, I haven't seen that improve it to everyone's satisfaction, but it does usually take it up a notch or two.
Okay, appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Ed in Burlington, on to you now. Hi, Ed.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Okay, the question I have is putting flooring over a basement floor. What are your recommendations on how to block moisture, or depending if you're putting down tile, carpet, or wood?
Okay.
Well, if you're putting down tile, you can allow the moisture to just come through it. But if you're putting a wood floor in a basement, then you have to be particularly concerned, because if you do have a moist or humid basement with a lot of moisture driving through, it's going to get, you know, the wood is going to absorb that moisture, and it's likely to cause problems. So there are some options for trying to prevent that moisture from driving through the slab into the wood floor. A lot of installers are putting down a heavy-duty visqueen over the slab as part of the underlayment. There are things that we can do with insulation boards to help further insulate and buffer from that slab prior to putting down a potential, you put down a subfloor prior to putting down a solid wood floor. But again, if you have a moisture problem, I just would not recommend a wood floor in a basement. With carpet, it's a little bit of a middle ground, but you do have to be concerned about mold. So again, visqueen can go down. There are products that can be applied to the concrete, that's kind of like putting your finger in a dam, in a crack in a dam. So
there you go.
Okay, the when you mentioned the insul board on the flooring underneath, if you're going to put a wood floor and a subfloor in there, what type of insul board are we talking? The white, the pink, foil face, what are we talking?
Well, we're really going to go with an extruded polystyrene. That's the pink or blue board. It's an exterior grade insulated sheathing is what we'd put up against that the concrete. And sealing all the edges and the seams, making that airtight, again, just trying to prevent that flow of moisture and that transfer is going to be key. So it's pink or blue board is fine.
And you're still talking about having to put a visqueen layer down before you put the insul board down or not?
Well, it depends on who you read. So in my house, I did not, and I don't have a problem. I keep my slab and drainage around the house, so my slab stays dry in my location. So I felt very comfortable without putting a visqueen down. Some, though, still will utilize that. And like Chad said, I think that if we address any potential for moisture from the exterior, I'm comfortable with just the extruded polystyrene without the poly.
All right, great. Thank you very much. Enjoy your show.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Ed. Appreciate it. Bob in Claybanks, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
I'm belonging to a volunteer group that's going to be demoing a small frame cabin. And I'm kind of looking for maybe a safety checklist for a project like that to make sure that we're all on the same page.
Well, how old is the cabin?
Well, it's 30, 40 years old.
Okay.
The basic structure is in pretty good shape, but, you know, as we're stripping the siding off and everything, I'm concerned about the roof, you know, well, the whole, you know, structure shifting as we're doing that. So I'm looking for either some advice from you guys, or if there's a place where that I might find, a safety list, so to speak, that we could kind of go through with everyone that's going to be involved.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure about giving you a checklist. But certainly to kind of summarize some of the things you might want to be concerned about. I mean, airborne contaminants are always something that we're concerned about when we're involved in demolition. So if things are being torn apart, you don't want to be inhaling the particulate matter. You should have an OSHA-approved a respirator on, as should everyone on the job site. And, you know, structurally, if the building is not structurally sound, then I would be very concerned about a crew of volunteers, you know, tearing things apart. But if it's basically a structurally sound building, I think you just have to use common sense.
Okay. Is it, you know, it's a kind of a rectangular building. So if the roof is likely to shift in this process at all, would it be more likely to go in the direction of the rafters or perpendicular to that? Or I'm wondering where we should keep our closest eye on bracing before we get to the point where we're ready to pull the top down.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure what to recommend there. You know, typically buildings are fairly redundant in their structural integrity. They don't just simply fall down, you know. You know, when you're building something, you start at the bottom and work your way up, and then when you take it apart, you start at the top and work your way down, so that hopefully, you're going to be taking precautions and working your way down as you disassemble. Are you completely disassembling the structure?
We're actually basically tearing it down, and we're looking to take as much out of the ground floor, and then there's just a, you know, a roof on top of a ground floor. So we're looking at taking everything as much off of the ground floor as we can, and then pulling over the top, and then, you know, taking taking the roof apart and disposing of it.
And there's material that's being salvaged?
Some of the siding might be, but we're more concerned with getting the building down than anything else.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good luck.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Bob in Dubuque, Iowa. On to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Just listening to a lot of radon questions on your show, and I am a licensed radon tester and mitigator in Iowa. And the questions regarding radon, wanted to try and add some information to that. The lady that called about the tri-level wanting to have it mitigated, but no one offering a guarantee, that is doable with no problem. The unit of measurement is actually picocuries per liter. I think I'd heard milliliter per something. But anyway, the threshold being 4, the World Health Organization recommended about a year ago that level be lowered to a 2.7 picocuries per liter. The EPA has not followed through on that yet, but in the near future, I do expect that they will. And so as far as the safety threshold, every home has some radon, and they have to set a limit. And as I mentioned, they do, the World Health Organization has recommended it be lowered to a 2.7. There's a University of Iowa radon study that the people interested in the radon may want to Google search. There's a Dr. Field at the University of Iowa had done a radon study connecting radon to lung cancer, and there's a lot of good information there. But just wanted to clarify some of the test. The one gentleman mentioned they put the plug-in monitor in when they remodel the basements. The one thing that you need to be concerned about there is those plug-in monitors, as well as the charcoal test kits that you can get from the health department, are only 75% accurate. So, you know, if you're measuring a 3, it could be a 4, it could be a 2. They also have to be recalibrated every year, which costs about as much as the unit itself. In Iowa, we're not even allowed to use them just because of the concern for accuracy and the recalibration. If someone doesn't have it recalibrated after the first year, then it may, you know, the homeowner's thinking they're safe. Radon levels do change and do fluctuate, so something to be concerned about there.
All right.
Thanks, Bob. That's good information.
Thank you very much for calling. So, the University of Iowa, Dr. Field, if somebody wants to look into that, Professor Field or Dr. Field, I assume if you put that in a web browser, you're going to find that's going to pop up and you'll find that information pretty quickly. Thank you again for calling. Dan from Plymouth has found a pink substance on his stone mortar basement walls. He can remove it with bleach, wondering if it might be mildew. Pink. Pink mildew?
Yeah, good question. Don't know if it's pink mildew or not. I guess if you wipe it off and it grows back, I think that's one indication that it certainly could be if it's just not able to, if it's going to grow back. But not an expert in mold and don't claim to be, so it's going to be hard for us to determine.
There are mold remediation specialists, and if he's really worried about it, I would say probably get a look, go to the phone book or what have you, and check out mold remediation specialists.
Yeah, absolutely.
Definitely.
Let's go to Bill in Lone Rock next. Bill, hello to you.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Hey, my question is that my house is about 10 years old, and the contractor built it with 6-inch walls, but he didn't do the Gorilla Wrap on the outside, the tieback paper. Would that make a difference?
Tyvek, that house wrap, is an option. You don't have to have the tie wrap or the Tyvek or Typar, many different products that are out there. Is it simply OSB and then siding, or is there any type of product over the substrate there?
No, just the OSB and then the siding on the outside. I do notice, though, during these harsh winters that we're having here in Wisconsin, that you can see the condensation building up on in between or outside on the siding, mm-hmm. where it looks like where they nailed the OSB to the 2x4s or the 2x6s. Mm-hmm. So it looks like there's moisture escaping. So my concern is, am I losing my heating and cooling through the outside walls because it doesn't have the tieback paper on, or am I just kind of looking? I don't know.
What's the siding type? What type of siding do you have?
I have vinyl siding.
Vinyl siding over OSB. So the concern there is primarily just durability from wind-driven rain and moisture either migrating from the inside out or wind-driven rain from the exterior, getting in there to the OSB and really just staying wet for too long and creating some damage there. Certainly a common practice would be to protect that OSB with whether it's a tar paper or a house wrap or insulated foam sheathing. Those are all products that I think are going to make a more durable structure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. A lot of builders, the code is moving towards requiring a good rain plane on the outside of a building, and it is true that it is not currently required in many states, but, I mean, we need to keep water out of structures, and that's what that Tyvek is doing.
And with that, we have to conclude. John, Chad, thank you so much.
Yeah,
thank
thanks,
you.
Larry.
They will be back, and we'll do this again. Chad Spade is owner of Chad's Carpentry in Madison. Take a look at the website, chadscarpentry.com. John Viner with the Energy Center of Wisconsin. Their website, ecw.org. Coming up tomorrow after 11, we have a Garden Talk program. Shelley Ryan, the Wisconsin gardener from Wisconsin Public Television, our guest. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.